Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
I think when you do a show like this, it's about time that the young people who may be viewing this thing realize that there's a lot more to music than just playing one chord or two chords going out and trying to make money.
Telling you, bro, it's been happening, bro.
Not too much.
Still hitting no more Peggy O's.
Everybody, Shane Terrio here. Thanks for tuning in, Riff Raff. How's everybody doing? I'm doing great. Thank you for asking. Through this coronavirus hiatus, if you're listening 50 years from now, look it up on whatever technology you have available now and see what we're going through at this point. It's pretty crazy. Been productive, though. I'm hoping that you've been productive, too. Maybe doing something you haven't been putting off for a while. Anyway, I have a great guest I'll tell you about in a sec. I wanted to give a shout out to, there's more than a few people, but Rex Singleton, a couple of listeners that made some little donations through my PayPal. It does cost money to operate this site and post Riff Raff, and I'm not trying to make money off of it, but if you happen to feel so inclined, want to make a little contribution to the cause, it helps me make episodes on a more timely basis. The way to do that would be paypal.me/funkyguitar. paypal.me/funkyguitar. Or just buy some music. We're listening to a track called Little Hat from my record Grease Factor. Checkouts, buy some of GE's music. Buy some, be more my podcast music. It all helps. And we musicians are a generous bunch. Alright, today's guest is Mr. G.E. Smith. How cool is it when you get to interview not only a legendary guitar player like G.E., but somebody who actually stood in, I'm standing in his shoes because he was the guitar player in the heyday. When I say heyday, I mean the 80s hits, mega hits that Daryl Hall and John Oates had. G.E. played on all that stuff, Private Eyes, Kisses on My List, Man Eater, all the famous songs you know. G.E. was right there. And believe me, I asked him a lot of questions that I wanted to find out some things about. But I knew of G.E. growing up as a kid in the 80s and watching Saturday Night Live and waiting every weekend to see what cool guitars he would have or what guest he would have, Eddie Van Halen or Eric Clapton or somebody sitting in. That was the heyday of late night TV, if you ask me. But anyway, I'm thrilled to have G. on as a guest. A lot of great stories. Had to do this on Skype, which you know is not my favorite way to do this. I would have much preferred to sit with G with guitars in hand. But it came out pretty great, and G dropped some amazing stories on here. Feel like we could have talked for another couple of hours. So G's got a new album coming out with Leroy Bell, and a great singer. They just partnered together. There's a few singles out right now on the internet. One's called America, Let the Sun Shine In. There's one called Black is the Color. There's three out right now. But the record is called Stony Hill. Should be out next month, August. Check it out. Here we go. Hope you enjoy this one.
Much better.
Wow.
Yeah, it's better. You, I can see you better and hear you better too.
Modern technology. There we go. Yeah. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Ain't that the truth?
Due to coronavirus and logistic limitations, I'm virtually interviewing the legendary G. Smith, and I'm thrilled that you could join me on Riff Raff. I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time, G. So through the marvels of modern technology, here we go.
Here we are.
Yeah, good, man. Yeah. Man, thank you, G, for doing this.
Sure.
Yeah, I've you know, been wanting to meet you anyway. You know, I feel like I know so much about you, man. I hear all these great stories.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's definitely some stories. How long have you been playing with Daryl and John?
7 years.
7 years. Okay. That's how long I was there. I did 79 to 85. So I was there 6 years.
Yeah. You were the heyday, man. The big time years. Yeah.
It was funny when I started with them. I'm sure you know their career story. You know, they had like Sarah Smile and Rich Girl in the middle of the 70s. And then they got into that thing with Todd Rundgren, and they did that Along the Red Ledge record, which wasn't their biggest record.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Probably their like least successful record. And I think that they had spent a lot of the money that they had made on a pre-production for this huge tour that they planned, and they, you know, there was a lot of production on the album. It was an expensive album to make, I think. So they were kind of like broke, you know, when I came along. I was getting $200 a week.
Wow.
For $100 to play the guitar and $100 to drive one of the station wagons. And we were playing bars.
Wow. I didn't know.
We were playing like joints, you know,
wow,
all over the country. But, you know, we would, like, fly into a place, get a couple of rented station wagons, load the gear in, and off we'd go. And we did that for several months, and then things picked up, you know. And,
right.
And it went up to Learjets and limos and stayed there the rest of the time. It just got bigger and bigger.
Yeah, for sure, man. Yeah. I saw your interview. You were talking about Daryl the first time you met him. It was something about shoes or a jacket or so. Is that true?
No, actually, the first time I met him, a guy named Eddie Zine, who had played drums with them in the middle 70s. Then I worked with Eddie in 78. We did a record and a tour with a group called Desmond Child and Rouge. And Desmond's a great songwriter.
Yeah.
Rouge, these three girls, these great singers. And so I got to be friendly with them. And so Eddie, at some point in the summer of 79, maybe it was 78, I don't know, 78 or 79, Eddie goes by the studio where Daryl and John are making a record to say hello. He's not playing with the band anymore, but he goes by to say hello. And then he comes to me and he says, hey man, they need a guitar player. You know, they've been using some different session guys and stuff, but it's not working out. You know, so I'll take you by. So then we go by and I meet them and talk to them. And I go the next day to Daryl's apartment. And I come in and we start talking, and well, we're Pennsylvania guys. We're all three of us Pennsylvania guys.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And then I was wearing something at the time, you know, and Daryl said, that's cool, shoes or a shirt or something, you know. And I said, yeah, well, man, you always wear great clothes. We started talking about clothes. I never took my guitar out of the case. We just talked. And then he said, okay, come to the studio tonight. And that was it.
Yeah, you know? It's a vibe thing. I get it. I understand him now, the way he picks up on vibe. And he knew that you would fit. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I got to meet Eddie Zine. I know he was pretty tight with Charlie DeChant, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he just had a big birthday.
He sure did. I saw your, we all gave him a shout out on video.
Yeah. Yeah. His video.
You got any, I mean, you know, for instance, I've checked out some of the old Hall & Oates stuff, like, I say old because it was early on, but the heyday of, like, what was that concert, the July 4th concert, where everybody's, like, helicopter, it's on YouTube, and man, you're doing all this cool stuff, like, you did the windmill.
Liberty Park.
Liberty Park. What do you remember about that day? Because that just seems like, that's just the ultimate.
It was amazing. That summer, it was like Live Aid, Farm Aid, you know, and we did all those things. And like at Live Aid, we kind of wound up being the house band, you know, backed up Mick Jagger and Tina Turner, some other folks.
Was that you and that was you and T-Bone, of course. Was that Mickey Curry too? Yeah, Mickey. That was the section. Yeah,
sure. And I think Daryl played. I have a great picture of Daryl, Mick Jagger, Tina Turner, John, and myself standing around a piano.
Wow.
Big, I think the Yamaha. You know, big Yamaha electric piano from those times. It was amazing. But that Liberty State Park thing, they had done some kind of work like refurbished the Statue of Liberty in the harbor there. And so it was about that. So, yeah, they helicoptered us from the city over to the island where the park was going to be. And on the way, they like took us through like some of the streets in the city, like low, you know, like lower than buildings, the police, you know, police helicopter. Flying with the cops is the best. We go over, and then we went to the island, and they actually took us up into the Statue of Liberty and let us go up in the, where people don't get to go, like up in the torch, you know?
Yeah.
These old wooden steps going up there.
Wow, amazing.
That was cool. And then the concert was amazing. You know, a lot of people, very exciting. And at that point, we had been on the road with that band for 4 years, pretty much. What we used to do, we'd make a record, and usually at Electric Lady, as it was working out, for about 2.5-3 months. We take a month off, then we go back out on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And it took 9 months to do what they called the world, you know, go around. Daryl and John were huge in Japan. And after about like maybe 82, when they had gotten really, really big and MTV had come on in 81, and they were all ready for MTV. When it came on, they had like 7 videos in the can ready to go.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
So they were really smart. You know, Tommy Mottola, who was managing them at the time,
right,
hooked up with those people at MTV, and he knew it was coming, and Daryl and John were right on it, you know. And they got the best people to direct and do things. So they were really ready for that period. And great songs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, man.
Starts, right, Shane? It starts
with
songs.
Absolutely. I remember a couple months into the gig, you know, I sit with Daryl sometimes and we'll go through the set. And I was checking out some older clips. And I saw it might have actually been from that Bicentennial concert, Did It in a Minute, which was always one of my favorite Hall & Oates songs. And the version you did, the guitar parts are different than on the record, man. I copped all your shit. The little on the verses, you know, such a killer thing. And Daryl was like, I said, man, I always loved that song, you know. And Daryl said, we haven't done it in a long time. So I found a version, you're on guitar, killing it, I think with a Marshall stack. Daryl has a Is it a? It's a Gibson tenor guitar. I guess that's how he started playing.
Four-string stuff, because, yeah. You know, playing mandolin and mandola.
Yeah, but what, man, great songs, great parts. I mean, just killer, man. As a matter of fact, I don't want to talk too much. I want you to talk, but maybe you'll remember some of this stuff. I have three multi-track, all the sessions of No Can Do, Man Eater, Kisses on My List, Transferred from 2-inch, which I guess they were at Hit Factory. I had to do some things for Daryl to edit some things, and we needed the masters. But you pull them up, everything at zero, no panning, no effects, no nothing. It sounds like a friggin' hit record. It's unbelievable. And I solo up all the parts, all your shit, and all of John. It's just engineering skills, songwriting skills, tones, everything, man.
I mean, well, haven't you always found when you're in the studio, if it's a great song and there's a great singer singing it, it makes it so easy to play nice parts.
Mm-hmm.
Just come up with stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I always played everything, not just with Daryl and John, but everything I've ever done. I listen to the singer, and I find the melody, and I use the notes from the melody. A, it always works with the song, and B, the singer kind of subconsciously goes, oh, yeah, that's right. That's what I'm singing, you know. So it just works.
Right.
It works. Yeah, but they had such great songs. It's funny. In my memory, and this could be like a partial memory, you know how things you remember from a long time ago, and
sure.
It's kind of true, but maybe it's not. Like, I remember Man Eater. I remember John playing it as it was like a bossa nova. The Whoa First Becomes part, you know? Like,
oh yeah, that sounds like something he would do.
Oh, she'll chew you up. Whoa, whoa, here she comes. Playing it on the piano. And Daryl listening to it and talking about it. And then we go away. And the next day, Daryl comes in and he's got that verse and he's got the beat now, you know.
Yeah.
And me and T-Bone and Mickey had suggested the Motown feel for it, you know? and Daryl just jumped on that and had that great lift up into the verse, you know, up into the major for the verse. Just good songs, good songwriting, good songs and singing. Can't beat
absolutely, man. It's still the best. Let me ask you about a couple of quote deep cuts that I like and we've done on Daryl's show. First one's Go Solo.
Oh, yeah, Go Solo. I love that song.
Great song.
Great song.
Great guitar solo, by the way.
Thank you. I don't even remember. Daryl, I always thought that was a very sincere song from him. You know?
Yeah. Like,
I mean, he's a professional, right? So he could sit down with somebody and write a song. He could sit down by himself and write a song almost to order. But I always thought that one, he really meant it.
Man, that song has some cool chord changes. Those really hip chord changes. But the guitar solo, I copped your solo because we did it on Daryl's show with Gavin DeGraw. I mean, I copped the gist of it. And really great, man. I mean, I love that. It's one of my favorites.
I'm just playing blues on almost all the songs where I play solos. I'm just playing blues, you know?
Yeah.
Funny one is Private Eyes. You know that intro?
Sure.
That,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The leaves fell from the trees, September. It's like an old standard, you know?
Wow.
And I remember Mottola cracking up when I played that melody.
That guitar solo on that tune is great, man. It's like, it's, you know, it's what's the word? Sacrosanct. Like, you can't mess it up because everybody in the audience is singing it. They know that solo, you know, it's like Stairway to Heaven or some shit.
So, I think when I was playing that solo, that like I started playing it and then Daryl was singing me some notes, if I remember correct.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very melodic.
Yeah.
It's a vocal kind of a solo.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But again, it's such a great song. You could play solos all day long.
I know.
They're all going to sound good.
Let me throw another oddball at you. What about Delayed Reaction? Remember that song?
Oh, yeah. Delayed Reaction. Yeah.
That's got some quirky bar. 5-4, 6-4.
Yep. I remember that was really fun to record. I remember just being an Electric Lady recording that. Just, you know, fun. I had a great time with those guys. You know, we were young, you know, at the time. We were all in our 20s and stuff when I was around. And I was such a rube, you know, when I first joined them. I hadn't been around much, you know. I had done some things, but hadn't really traveled a whole lot. And it was a great education, you know, being with them, a physical education and a sociological education, you know, to really get out and see the United States before the old weird America, as they call it, before it was gone.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Like, because I joined them before MTV, and it was still regional. When you'd go to the South, you're in Tennessee, right?
No, I live in New Orleans. I just have a Tennessee cell.
Okay, well, down South. When you'd go to New Orleans, or you'd go to Tennessee or to Atlanta or somewhere, it was different than being up here in New York or Pennsylvania, where I came from, you know? It was really different. Once MTV came on in 81, within, I'd say, 6 to 9 months, the regionalism started to go away. People started, the kids especially that were coming to the shows, started dressing the same. They started trying to lose their accents. And then gradually, through the early 80s, stuff started going away. Like there used to be diners.
Yeah.
Like there was a diner in Union, Tennessee, I remember, that we loved. It was gone, you know? Stuff started to disappear. And T-Bone used to just be so sad about things like that, you know?
Right.
So, we really saw the country change big time. Even Japan. From the first time we went to Japan, where it was really foreign and different, you know, till by like 83, you know, we'd go every year. By 83, it was like, Tokyo at least, was like being in New York City, you know? So it was a great time I was really lucky to be there for that tremendous ascendancy that they did. Those hits, I mean, like Maneater, it was an inescapable song. Wherever we went in the world, it was playing on the taxi radio. It was playing in the supermarket when you went to get something to take back to the room, you know? Hmm. Huge, giant records.
Wow. What an amazing place to be in your 20s, man. That's
yeah.
The last time I actually saw Daryl and John was in February, because all this coronavirus, we did Madison Square Garden, and it was sold out. People still go because of those songs.
Yeah, of course.
You know, those songs, man. It's the power of those songs. But
those mean a lot to people, you know, people that were young then when those records were out, you know.
Yeah, they want to feel a little of that nostalgia, but plus they're great songs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, we could just talk a whole episode about that, but you've done so many other things. I don't want to keep harping on that. But
okay, I feel like I owe a lot to Daryl and John. You know, I learned a lot. I always felt that, like, I mean, I got to play some nice stuff on the records. You know, I think my favorite thing that I ever played on any of their records is that intro to Every Time You Go Away.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, that Memphis style.
Yeah, Reggie Young and all that stuff. Uh-huh.
It's a perfect Telecaster song, and I'm a Telecaster guy. Used the neck pickup. Really got that, like, Teeny Hodges, you know, the guy that played on the Al Green records. That's who I was thinking about when I played that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so much. And then when we did that Apollo concert uptown, the Apollo Theater, because they had fixed up the Apollo and they were reopening it, and David Ruffin and Eddie Kendrick were in the band at that point, you know?
Yeah, that's amazing. It is amazing.
I remember that day, we were all up in the dressing room in the afternoon, and David and Eddie were just kind of like, warming up their voices, and they started singing this gospel song, "Oh Mary, Don't You Weep." And me and T-Bone came in with the other two harmonies. And they looked at us like, wait a minute, how do you guys know that song? And we're like, come on, man, Shirley Caesar and the Caravans.
Yeah, oh, Martha, don't you moan.
Yeah. You know, that's the greatest song. So stuff like that, you know. Unbeatable.
Just a little side note, because I'm sort of curious, but what amps were you using on? Were there Marshalls, or on the records were you using other amps? Or I'm always curious.
Oh, I use Marshalls on the records. If you see me using Marshalls, it's because they're rented.
Okay.
That would be like, because I couldn't bring my Fenders for whatever reason. You know, no, I'm a Fender amp guy.
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah, but I've seen all those videos with John and Daryl.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, that's all. The Marshalls were rented, and sometimes, like in England or Germany, we'd rent AC-30s, you know. But that was, I remember that on one tour, we had, we were out somewhere in the world, and John kept saying, man, you know, the Marshalls, yeah, they're okay, but it's not the good sound. So we had my basements sent out from the city. And at the end of that tour, we ended in Brussels, in Belgium, and the gear got shipped back, and somebody stole my amp. I had a big, you know, road case with all the amp heads in it, two old small box Marshall 50s, two like 61 basement heads, you know.
God. Really,
back then, you could still get all that stuff, so I got more basements, you know, but yeah. It was a thing that we used to do. We kind of got like, you know, that the random possibilities cards.
Yeah, Brian Eno and
the Brian Eno thing.
Yeah.
So we had those in the studio. Daryl, I think, had brought them in at Electric Lady, and so I loved that. I always loved the randomness idea. Uh-huh. Anyway, you know, in life. So a thing that we would do. If it was time for me to play a solo, like the solo on Family Man, we did this. We set up all my amps and all my guitars in the studio, just put them up like in a line. And then we like ordered a pizza or ordered Chinese food or something. And the delivery guy, I would take him out in the studio and he would pick a guitar and an amp. That's what I would use for the solo. And this is what I did on Family Man. That's what I used for the solo. And I wouldn't touch the settings on the amp. Whatever the amp was at, that's what I played.
Force limitations.
Yeah. And it always worked. It always sounded good. It was always a tone that worked. I did that two or three times. But I noted that Family Man, that whatever it is, that, you know, that bam, 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 bang, and solo is... He picked an SG and a
delivery man. Delivery man picked.
Yeah.
Wow. What a story, man. That's great. Really great. I had no idea. That's really cool.
I'll tell you, I was thinking about this morning, a real guitar geek thing. You know how guys take the covers off their humbuckers?
Yeah. Yeah,
it does change the sound. It gives you this like quieter kind of thing. So the oldest picture that I've ever been able to find is Clapton, April of 65, playing in John Mayall's band. And he's got the Les Paul and he's got the covers off, right? So I was doing some work with Eric one time, and we were waiting. You know how, as they say, most of the show business, 90% is waiting. Mm-hmm. So we're in one of those, like, waiting for an hour or something to get something set up so we could play. And I said, man, could I ask you some, like, real guitar geek questions? And he laughed. He said, yeah, go ahead, man. It was just me and him. And I said, I got this picture of you with Mayall in April of 65, and you got the covers off your humbuckers. And he really thought about it. I could see. He really thought about it. He said, well, now they're in London, right? Down south of England.
Right.
He goes, well, all the bands up north were doing that. I went, the bands up north? Who are you talking about? Freddie and the Dreamers? You know, the Beatles? They weren't taking the covers off their humbuckers. So I don't know exactly what he meant, but that has always just astounded me that either somebody told him to do that or he did it. But he's the first one I ever saw.
Wow. You never know, man. Some of that stuff just comes from. There's a tune called Shadookie Doo. Maybe you've heard it.
Oh, yeah. Shadookie Doo.
I love you.
John Hammond and Dr. John.
Well, that's on that tree. What is that called? That record they did in the 70s, but it's an old New Orleans tune.
The original.
The original one from the 50s, the guitar solo, it sounds so ratty and messed up, you know. And I asked Art Neville about it. He goes, man, the guitar player on the session, the amp broke. And it was like kind of, you know, just sounded crappy and they just left it. And I said, really? Wow, listen to that. I mean, it sounds like the shittiest fuzz tone hip, you know. But you're talking like probably 57, 56. And I asked Mac about it, and Mac, he said the exact same story. He goes, and then, you know, Mac, he goes, that was the first guitar solo with extortion that was ever recorded.
Buddy Guy would always say that. He'd say, man, I got some extortion on my amp tonight.
Or what was that? Everything I do gonna be funky, you know.
Gonna be funky from now on.
I asked Art Neville. Art was on the session. I asked him. He goes, "Yeah, well, the engineer was from North Louisiana, and he talked like he had a little accent from up North Louisiana." And they told Alan Tuesday, and he said, "Man, this cat talks hip. You should just leave it on the record." And that's how it ended up on there.
Oh, that's great.
So that's why I do this podcast, G, because your stories, man. Who's ever gonna hear that shit? Who's going to know, like, you know, all the stuff you just said? I mean, some of it you've probably said in interviews before, but all that little inside stuff, man, it's just gold. Great. You know? Yeah.
Man, I'll tell you something about, like, I've really, really researched this about distortion on guitar players playing with distortion, right?
Yeah.
So one of the earliest ones that got recorded, at least, there was a guy before Hubert Sumlin in Howlin' Wolf's band. I think his name is Wilbur Smith, but his name was Smith. There's records that they did at Sun, and even before that, like really early 50s, 52, 53, his amp is totally distorted, and it's insane. I mean, it's like call the police time, you know. but the earliest one I found, you know, Charlie Christian, right?
Yeah, sure.
Charlie Christian, he was the first guy to go, oh, electric guitar. Look what you can do. You know, he was the first one. I mean, Les Paul was trying to do it. Different guys were trying to do it. But Charlie was the first one to really take an electric guitar and wail.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Sure.
So he's on the Benny Goodman recordings and stuff. You know, that's a smooth one. So he would make those records. Then they would go to this place called Minton's, M-I-N-T-O-N-S, a club, and they would jam. Krupa, Charlie, different guys, you know. So there's this tape. Thank God somebody was up there taping some of this stuff. And at one point they finish a song, and you hear who I think is Krupa say to him, hey, Charlie, you call one. And he goes, okay, man, B flat. One, two.
Wow.
It's like 1941.
Wow. One he P90, hits. One whatever that was. It was a P90, I guess.
Before. So he must have at some point realized if I hold some of these notes, it'll just keep going like a horn player. But he goes, one, two, boom. Oh, yeah. So people were doing
amazing. Oh, those are great stories, man. Those are really great. You seem like your career, the path it took, it seemed like you timed it. Well, maybe it was just
pure luck.
Pure luck, not that talent was luck. I just mean the timing of you falling into SNL and doing all this stuff while you were working with John and Daryl. I mean, it seemed like it just happened. Because forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think – you took the SNL gig and they were taking time off or something like that? Yeah. When does that ever happen?
By the summer of 85, we had literally been on the road or in the studio for almost 6 years. You know, like they worked. When we weren't in the studio, like I said, it was a couple weeks off and we'd be back in the bus and boom, gone. Or on an airplane going overseas somewhere. And so by July of 85, when we did Live Aid and that Liberty Park concert and Farm Aid and all that stuff, by that summer of 85, they were tired. And they'd made some money. You know, they'd had all those giant hits now for 5 years. And they said, we're going to take some time off. So fine. And then as it happened, Lorne Michaels was returning to Saturday Night Live. He had been there from the beginning of the show, 75. To 80, then he left. Now he's returning to the show. The original musical director on the show was Howard Shore. So Lorne just said, okay, Howard, we're going back. And Howard said, I can't go back. I'm doing film scores now. You know, I'm making real money now, you know, and doing some good work. But he said, well, we'll get GE to do it. You know, so that's how I just fell into that, just luck.
Wow.
Just because I know all those guys, you know.
Yeah. Well, I remember being a kid and watching Saturday Night Live and seeing you and T-Bone and every commercial break and bumper, all the cool blue shit you were playing. And, you know, it was just different because everything I was exposed to at that time. I mean, I came up in the 80s, a kid, you know, so I was, you know, into Eddie Van Halen and stuff. And to see you with the old tellies and, you know, playing the old shit with the great rhythm section, T-Bone with the bass. It was so cool, you know.
T-Bone, I miss him.
I know. I want to talk about T-Bone too, man.
He was the greatest. He was such an incredible musician. And, I mean, you know, I was a bar band guy, you know. So I had played many, many, many years in the bars. From the time I was about 11, I started playing in bars and all up through the years. So I knew a lot of songs. And I think that's what always worked for me when I would get like a gig with Daryl and John. I knew all the Delphonics and the Dells and the Temptations and Chi Lights and Smokey Robinson. I knew those songs. Yeah. You know, and they knew those songs.
Well, that's Daryl's baby food right there.
They knew those songs, man. So not only like did I know the songs, I knew those chords. I knew that style. I knew, you know, the all that stuff. You know, those piano chords that Daryl loved to play. So I fit in well with that. But T-Bone, when he came on, almost the first thing he did is the video for Private Eyes. And if you go look at that video, he is terrified. He didn't play on Private Eyes. That's John Siegler playing bass on Private Eyes. But then we hired T-Bone and he did that video and he's terrified. He can barely move. It's hysterical. because later on, you know, he got when he once he got calm and acclimated to things, he moved like crazy.
Yeah.
T-Bone's College of Musical Knowledge. But anyway, he came along and he knew more songs than I knew. You know, he was really the first guy I met that knew more, and he could play them on any instrument.
That's,
you know, he was the New York State accordion champion when he was like 11, 12. So he was a massively great keyboard player, an incredible guitar player. We had a band that we did with some other friend of ours, a Domino Band, and me and T-Bone played guitar, both of us. And it was great. So much fun, you know? And obviously the best bass player.
Yeah.
And then one night we were producing a session, and I think we were in Electric Lady. And the drum part was like a New Orleans, like a little second line mm-hmm. kind of feel almost, you know. And a really good drummer who could play anything couldn't quite get it, mm-hmm. you know. And we're saying, well, like, it's this, and, you know. And he was playing it, but it just didn't have the feel. So T-Bone sits down at the drums, and I start thinking to myself, don't do this to me. You play every other instrument better than anybody. Don't do this. And he goes, whack it, the boom.
Oh, man, laid it down.
Back it. And I had never seen him play drums. And I knew him, man. I knew him good, you know. So he was the greatest. And funny. I'm sure you've heard many, many stories.
I have. And my one regret is I never got to meet him, man. I was playing with the Neville Brothers. We played the Superdome Endymion Parade. This is a long time ago. And Daryl and John were there. And
that's how I know you. I saw you play with the Neville Brothers.
Yeah, I was there. I was with them from late 96 through, I don't know. I was there probably 8-9 years, but I remember Daryl wasn't hanging out. There was a common green room, basically, and, you know, everybody's hanging, drinking, and hanging out. And T-Bone was there talking to Art Neville, and I think George Porter was there for a minute, too. And yeah. I walked away, and I just never went in. I never said, man, he was 3 feet from me. And I remember later that night, I stood on side the stage, and I was going, holy shit, man, I forgot these songs. Wow, this, and the band was grooving so hard. And that was it. I never got to meet him. You know, I know so many people that knew him and worked with him. And
he's the nicest guy.
Yeah. I don't think guy. I've ever heard one. I've only heard great things about T-Bone out of all the people, yeah. You know. But
there's no bad things. I'll tell you one more great story about T-Bone. You know, I'm sure you heard about how he was really into food.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So after things got like very successful, we're going to go out to do another big, you know, United States tour in the bus. So we get our own bus outfitted. So T-Bone has a little grill built into it, right? A couple of burners and a grill, a flat, you know, metal grill. And we get a freezer down in one of the bays. So we can take, and we've got steaks and lobster and, you know, all kind of great food. Right. We always had great food in that band, I got to say. You know, we always ate very well. So anyway, T-Bone, for a while, would do this thing in the morning as everybody starts waking up in the bunks. He had a little, like, a white apron, a order pad, and he'd come up to the bunks and say, light toast, no butter. And he'd make breakfast, you know.
Wow.
So one time we're pulling into Kansas City and we want to go to this particular Bryant's Barbecue, I believe it was called, Bryant's. And this is, you know, before internet. We don't have Estelle on our phone with the map telling us where to go, you know.
Yeah.
We're guessing. We know it's kind of over there. As you pull into Kansas City, we know it's off on the right somewhere. So we get off the exit, and we're entering the bus, and we're going along, and he's got the little window in the door, in the, you know, the inside, outside door. He's got the little window open, and he's like got his nose stuck out like a dog. Going, go about 3 blocks and turn right. 10 minutes later, man, we're in front of the place. He could smell the barbecue.
That's unreal.
The guy was classic.
Wow, what a character. Man. Yeah, that's that. Those are great stories. I never heard that one. I've heard the salami, sacrificial salami, and the those stories. But
yeah.
So getting back to SNL, you and T-Bone were there, and was that like a real high pressure thing for you? I mean, it seems like with time working TV and things, was that the first MD, the TV thing that you had done at that point? I know you had been music director on other things, but as far as a weekly thing like that, being under pressure, timing, and
No, I had done another show for Lorne. Saturday Night Live, of course, has always been on NBC, but he did a show for a minute called The New Show on CBS, and I was the band leader, music director guy for that. So I had done a little bit of TV, and of course I'd been on a lot of shows with Daryl and John and other people, you know, Bandstand and Soul Train and all that kind of stuff. So I was pretty well acclimated to playing in front of the camera, and you know, as long as I got a guitar in my hand, I'm fine.
Yeah,
that's why I have a guitar now, even just to talk to you. Like, people say to me, man, don't you get nervous when you get up there in front of 60,000 people and you got to play? I said, no, that's the only time I'm not nervous.
Mm-hmm. I can understand that.
I bet you can understand. Put on that guitar, I'm fine. I can talk to anybody. It's the rest of the time when I don't have the guitar, then I'm nervous.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Yeah. I had auditioned for Saturday Night Live about 10 years ago. Sean Pelton had initially referred me, and Lenny flew me out twice, and they were down to two guys, me and the guy that's doing it now. So I didn't get the gig. I guess Lauren didn't like me. But at one point, I think I almost had the gig because we played at SIR a few times, and we already discussed the money and everything. And I thought, but that was a bummer for me, man. That was a dream gig, you know. But
it's a great gig, but it also keeps you there in New York. You know, so you can't go out on the road with somebody. Although I did, you know, I went out with Bob Dylan while I was.
There's a whole nother segment of the interview. Yeah, Dylan.
And Bob was very cool about it. You know, there's only 20, or there used to be, anyway, when I was there, there was 20 Saturday Night Lives from October to like the end of May. It's kind of a school year, you know? And so those Saturday nights, Bob just didn't take a gig. Although it made for some very interesting airplane stuff, like, because this really happened. On Friday night with Bob, we played in Rio de Janeiro. Saturday night, I did the show.
Oh,
and on Sunday night, we played in Sao Paulo. And
wow.
And then went to Paris. And we did four nights or five nights in Paris. And I came home and did the show, and then I went to London and met back up with the band, and we did four or five nights in London.
Wow.
That was a crazy couple of weeks.
Sounds like it. Man, you must have been just completely disoriented.
Yeah, but it was fun. It was amazing.
Yeah.
No complaints, you know?
Wow.
I was so lucky to get to do all that stuff.
Man.
The best thing on Saturday Night Live was after the show had gotten very successful again, by about like 88, I came on in 85. By about 88, I went to Lorne and said, listen, man, we're doing these, what they call band shots, you know, the bumper things. And if there's a good guitar player in town, I'm going to invite him to come on and just play the night with the band. But don't announce it. Don't put it in TV Guide. Don't tell anybody. So the camera would come up on us, and there's Johnny Winter. Or Lonnie Mack, David Gilmore, or Eddie Van Halen, Hugh Sumlin, all those people, you know, and that got to kind of be a little thing. And guys like Kirk Hammett from Metallica told me one time, he said, yeah, man, we would watch to see, like, A, what guitar is he playing this week? And B, who's going to be playing?
I know that you were married to Gilda Radner, but were you particularly close to any cast members, hang out with anybody that you'd hang?
I knew Belushi pretty well. you know. I knew them all, you know.
Sure, yeah, obviously.
Lorraine Newman, I was very friendly with for a while there because she lived right down the street from me and Gilda and in the city. Billy Murray, I still, when I see Bill, we still have good talks, and he's a great guy. He's a very intelligent, you know, I mean, he's funny. He does all that goofy character and stuff, but that's a very intelligent, very well-read guy. He knows what's going on, you know. But yeah, they were great people, and it was a very exciting time those first 5 years. You know,
oh, that was the heyday, man. That was the
something brand new. You know, what people don't realize, Chevy Chase was only on for 1 year.
Really?
76. That's it.
I didn't realize that.
And then he went to Hollywood. See, he established that mold of you get on the show for a couple of years, and then you go to Hollywood and get the real money. You know, which is what most of them strive for.
Well, I didn't realize that. 1 year. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, Chevy was there for 1 year.
Yeah. Every couple months, man, I think it's from guitar playing, but I sleep and I twist my neck and it's just like,
yeah.
So if I'm doing this, it's just because I can't even turn like this right now.
Come on. Years and years and years with that weight around your neck, yeah. And your hands up in the air.
I know.
When I played with Roger Waters in from 2010 for about 6 years, I played bass on a lot of the show.
Right.
So to all of a sudden now be extending my hand out further, I'm still sore. I did something to my back and my shoulder, you know, because you get used to one thing and the bass is heavier. But that extending my arm out further really.
What trips me out is I watch bass players that adapt their upright technique, you know, this,
right.
And they play,
right.
And they play like that, and I'm going, yeah. Well, it's sort of like you don't really need to do that anymore. It's really bad for your wrist. It's kind of like traditional grip, like,
right.
It's kind of, you're not playing a marching snare angled anymore. I don't understand why, but I don't know. I'm not a drummer, but it seems like it's really bad for your wrists.
You know, T-Bone. Always, when I first met him, he was just playing with his fingers. He had always just played with his fingers. Very James Jamerson, you know. He was very influenced by Jamerson. Then, as we started going on the road and playing big arenas, you know, 19,000 to 25,000 kind of seat places, right away he realized that he wasn't getting the clarity he wanted. So he went to a pick,
mm-hmm.
And that really became his sound.
Did you play with a pick with Roger Waters on bass?
Only on one song. I played fingers for most of the songs, but there was one song that I had to play with a pick.
Yeah, I mean, I know I played bass, a little bass myself, and I noticed some bass players that are real bass players. They sort of frown on pick, you know. They think it's sort of cheating. Yeah. But man, what about Anthony Jackson and what about Carole Kaye? Yeah. They're not cheating. Yeah. I mean,
exactly.
So you're going to tell them they're not bass players?
Whatever you got to do to get the tone. I got to say, T-Bone realized right away after like three or four nights in one of those big arenas that he wasn't getting the clarity he could get in the studio,
right,
or on a small stage, you know. And he adapted right away to that. And I remember. When they recorded One-on-One, I remember T-Bone played the bass, fantastic bass part.
Yeah,
right?
Amazing bass part.
And he stood in the control room, just stood at the board, plugged right into the board. And I remember watching his right hand with that pick, that dum, 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 dum.
Wow. Dum.
The clarity of the notes, but still bottom, boom, big, low. And I remember me and Daryl and John, and I remember Daryl just watching him like, wow, I love you, man. This is what you're playing. That's what we want right there.
That's great, an amazing bass line.
Yeah.
Doom, 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 yeah. Doom, 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 doom.
So fucking beautiful.
Yeah. Do you remember a song called Bank on Your Love?
No. I don't remember that one.
I'm pretty sure you're on that record.
Bank on Your Love.
Let me see.
Which record is that on,
do
you know?
Let me see if I can find it real quick on iTunes.
I think the first record I was on was Ecstatic, I think. Or there might have been one before that.
Bank on Your Love.
Private Eyes.
It's on Big Bam Boom.
It's on Big Bam Boom, then, yeah. I was there.
I thought so, yeah. We did that song with Billy Gibbons was a guest on Live from Daryl's House, and we did that song, which is kind of an odd choice, but Billy wanted to do it, and really cool part, man. It's got like a half-step bend from the major seven. Mm-hmm. And, I learned all your parts on there. It was really neat. I mean, that whole sound of that whole New York, that big, Hit Factory, you can hear the room, and it's like... Yep. There's a clip on MTV, on YouTube, of, I think it was an MTV interview, because I asked John about it, and it shows you and T-Bone and Mickey cutting rhythm tracks for Go Solo, and Daryl's laying a vocal part, and he said after that they were faking mixing just for the MTV video, but man, that's just a cool time machine snapshot of what it must have been, you know. I don't know, I just fantasize about being around then.
Solo is such a great song.
Yeah.
Oh, Daryl just singing his heart out.
Bob Dylan stories?
Bob, when I got that gig, I went, before we started, we went out to California and rehearsed just a little bit, and then right away started doing shows. But I got out all my old photographs and stuff of like Mike Bloomfield and Robbie Robertson, and in almost every picture, they're stage right, off to Bob's right, and they are turned like looking cross stage, watching his hands. Every picture that you see of them, they're watching his hands. And you had to, I talked to Mike Campbell from Petty for a minute, from the Heartbreakers, another great guitar player in a great band.
Oh, yeah.
But I talked to him about that, and he said, yeah, you know, you just watch his hands. Bob, and who knows why, but yeah, he did like to change things up. Not necessarily a different key all the time, but a different feel. Like you do a song in four one night, and the next night it might be in three, you know. Same song.
But Tennessee Waltz in 4/4.
Tennessee Waltz in 4/4. I think we did do that. You know? But it was great. I love doing that. I've always loved doing that. That seat of the pants thing. I think that for a guitar player backing a singer, you play some of your best stuff when that's happened. When you barely know the song, that's great. I love that. Yeah. So I had a great time with Bob. I mean, hey, he's Bob Dylan, you know?
Oh,
I'm still amazed by him. Have you listened to his new record?
The new one? No, I haven't listened to it yet. I should check it out.
I mean, look, he's a older fella now, you know, and so he's adjusted his voice. He knows exactly what he's doing. The lyrics are unbelievable.
Of course, yeah.
He's the greatest. When I first got on there and we... We're out on the road, and Bob worked. I mean, we worked. We played many, many nights a week. You know, he didn't care. He'd just keep playing, just keep moving. That's what he seemed to like. But, like, for the first year almost, I mean, we would talk. He wasn't unpleasant, but we weren't, like, buddies or something, you know?
Yeah.
And then almost exactly a year, we're coming off stage at a state fair somewhere in the Midwest, Iowa, maybe Iowa State Fair, and he had a bus, the band had a bus, and the crew had a bus. We had three buses. We're coming off stage, and I'm heading for my bus, and I feel his hand on my shoulder behind me, and I turn around, and he goes, hey, ride with me tonight.
Wow.
So I get on his bus, and we're headed for wherever the next place was, headed for another joint, as he says, and He played cassettes in those days. He's playing me songs, not his songs, old stuff. You ever hear this one? You know about this guy? This you should know. And he's turning me on this, and he's giving me cassettes. Listen to this. Learn this. Not to play, just that I should know this.
Yeah.
You know? And that was great, man.
Yeah, that's priceless, man. Wow.
One of the amazing things he played me that night, he had a live tape of Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps from like maybe 57 or something. He says, now listen to this. And it's explosive rock and roll. And I'm listening to it, and the guitars are ripping, you know. And he said, who do you think that is? I said, it sounds like The Clash. And he goes, yeah, it's Gene Vincent. Yeah, it really sounded like The Clash.
Before CBGBs, man.
Way before CBGBs. Way before The Clash. Those guys probably were barely born at that point. They were amazing live, man. The Clash live, one of the best bands I ever saw. Amazing. The Who, the Stones, and the Clash.
Brings up this thing, G, I want to ask you, because I checked out a few of your interviews, which are great, by the way, the little on YouTube. Mm. And you said something that I think is relative to what we're talking about. I mean, you said that you wanted to be remembered, like if somebody goes, you know, years from now and they find some, like, I forget what you said exactly, but basically to paraphrase it, 100 years from now, somebody comes and they download something in their brain and go, wow, look at these guys hanging out. That's what you said. These guys hanging out in New York in the 80s, like in the studio, taking a smoke break. And these were the Cats, I believe is what you said. And you're talking about Gene Vincent and Dylan, and here we are now. I mean, do you think there are any more Cats? I mean, do you think there, you know, I think about the state of music today, not to be a downer. I just mean, do you think there's a need for, quote, Cats? Or is just, I don't know if I'm phrasing my question.
Yeah, you're phrasing it. I get it. What's that Paul Simon line? Every generation sends a hero up the pop charts.
That's a good answer. Right? Yeah.
It's true. It's true. But I never wanted to be that guy. You know, I never wanted to be the front man guy. I wanted to be a side man. I was very lucky. I got to do what I wanted to do. You know, like along the way, I've several times been kind of forced to do my own, like a solo record or something, you know. In 1980 was the first one. But my heart wasn't in it because that wasn't what I wanted. I wanted to play with these great singers, you know, to play behind Daryl and play behind David Bowie and Bob and whoever, you know. So I was very lucky to get to do some of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and just for the Cats. Yeah, that's what I wanted. Yeah. I'd look at the bands from the 30s and stuff, you know, Charlie Christian and Ben Webster hanging out, you know, those guys. And I go, yeah, that's what I want to be.
Yeah, I guess it's hard to have objectivity when you're sitting in 2020. I was working with Dr. John on his record, and I found an old video of him, Wrecking Crew, 1966 Sonny and Cher session on YouTube. Yeah. And I just happened to be checking it out to look, you know, I was like, wow, this is Gold Star, man, where they're probably doing probably Pet Sounds right now. They're working on this on a different day. And here's Sonny and Cher session. They pan the room and you see Barney Kessel. You see Jim Gordon on Vibes, Earl Palmer. And there's Mac smoking a cigarette playing at 335. And, you know, I showed it to him and he was just like, Yeah, it was me. What about it? And I'm just thinking, it's just another day. But I was just like, man, it just blows my mind. Because to me, those, you know, those were the L.A. Cats, you know.
And, cats.
And you were the New York Cats. I mean, who are the Cats now? I don't know. I don't know if there's even a need.
There are. You know, I mean, it's different now. You know, I think that the real Cats now are probably in the kind of hip-hop R&B world.
Right. Right.
And they're working on computers.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily, you know, playing an instrument. I have one of those pictures like you're talking about in Los Angeles. James Burton, Glenn Campbell, Howard Roberts, and Tommy Tosco. All four of them sitting there with guitars. I'll tell you a funny story like that, man. One of the first New York City session dates I ever got before Daryl and John, anything. When I had first come to the city to live in 78, I get a call and there was a guy named Rex Smith. He was a soap opera star at the time and he's doing a record. So I get to the session the first day and it's Jeff Baxter and Huey McCracken and me on guitars. right? So I'm terrified. I'm terrified anyway, because I haven't done many sessions, you know? And here's Jeff Baxter, who I'm in awe of from the Steely Dan stuff, you know? And Hugh McCracken, who's played on...
He played on Mac stuff, yeah, on Dr. Johnston.
And he's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So... We're kind of looking at each other, and Huey, who was just the nicest guy in the world, he goes, all right. He says, I'm going to play acoustic. He says, Jeff, you play the top three strings. Gee, you play the bottom three strings. And we pretty much did the whole record like that. It was just, you know, it was fun. The record never did anything. I don't even remember, you know, much. I'll tell you another story like that. This is great. There's a thing called the Rhythm and Blues Foundation. That was set up by like Ruth Brown and Bonnie Raitt, I think, and people like that.
Yeah.
To help these performers when they get older and maybe they're sick and they're not able to work anymore, you know, help get them some money. So they always did that. It was a Los Angeles thing. They always did it in Los Angeles. But one year, for some reason, they bring it to New York and they're doing it in New York. And so they hire me to be the MD on the thing. And it's myself, Steve Cropper, and Ry Cooter. Wow. On guitar. So again, I'm terrified, right? But they're great guys. And I had actually worked with Cropper some with Dylan. So I was okay with him, knew him. And I was just, you know, honored to meet Ry. Ry changed my life. His playing, you know, everything. Mandolin. I started playing mandolin because of him. But anyway, so we're at the thing. And the finale of the show is Little Richard. Okay. Now, Little Richard, he doesn't rehearse. You know, you don't rehearse with Little Richard. He talks to you for a minute, and then you go play. So Richard comes right at the end of the rehearsal, about an hour before the actual show, you know, and he sits at the piano, and he goes, all right, and he looks. He goes, guitar players, come here. And he starts playing the lick from Lucille, you know.
Yeah.
With his left hand just banging it, man, just killing it. Rhythm, sound, every, killing it. And he goes, play that. And Cooter goes, you want all three of us to play that? He goes, yeah, play that, and don't play nothing else. Like, go away. I'm done with you guys. Go away. Don't play nothing else. And we did. It was hysterical.
Wow.
Stuff like that, that's like the Cats, you know.
Oh, yeah, man. Absolutely. But Cooter, I've never gotten to meet him, man. He seems like a pretty intimidating cat. But
I don't know, you know, like I don't know him well or anything. I've met him a couple times. I got to, at that thing, I took him to lunch, you know, which was really great. Just to get to ask him some questions. Because his first whole bunch of five or six first albums, and then other stuff too that he's done, they're just so good and changed my life. His first record, Ry Cooter, where he's standing in front of the Airstream.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
He's got the cape. That's his first record. And Little Feet, first album, both came out. They were both on Warner Brothers, and they both came out like early in 71. In my memory, like within about a month of each other. And those two records, man, I got those records and just played them over and over. I still play at shows when I perform. I still do the Cooter stuff, like
Yeah.
I remember Lindley laughing at me when I played him that, and he said, "Man, he plays it in an open D tuning." He said, "You play it in C. Yeah, you got the melody, but you know." It's, but yeah, those records changed my life. Lowell George is playing.
What's funny is that is all those cats came from, well, not all of them, but Lowell and Ry. Ry was, I guess, came up with blues, but he was in Beefheart's band, and then Lowell was in Zappa's band, and I knew Richie Havre pretty well.
Lowell in Zappa's band. I didn't know it was Lowell at the time because we used to go see the Mothers at the Fillmore East in like 67, 68. The Anderson Theater, which was right across the street from the Fillmore, up Second Avenue a little bit. We saw the Mothers there. We'd come in from Pennsylvania, you know. But yeah, Lowell, amazing, right?
I know, man, I hear those guys and I go, wait, they're from California? Like, man, not that California doesn't have soul, but that's some deep shit, man. Like, you hear
Kuda's from Santa Monica, and Lowell was from Mulholland Drive. I mean, he was like he wasn't like from some poor family, you know. He was from family that was happening. But man, you just can't beat that stuff. You know, it's just playing the G scale, but hey, it's how you play it.
Yeah, you try and write it exactly.
You write it, man. And his singing, Lowell's singing. You ever hear his solo album?
Yeah. Thanks All You Did Here, of course.
That song, 20 Million Things.
Yeah.
Woo! Yeah, I remember I played that song for Daryl one time. We were like in a van or something, and I always had a boombox, you know, back then. And I played 20 Million Things for him, and he just kind of like, just kind of shook his head like, yeah, damn, that's something.
I played Daryl some Beefheart. He loved it. He goes, man, I had Trout Mask Replica. We used to listen to this all the time.
Yeah.
He's into some pretty out stuff.
Man. Yeah, Daryl likes some sideways stuff.
Yeah, prog, progressive rock. And
yeah.
Why don't we talk about your new project you have coming out? G and Leroy Bell.
Leroy Bell.
It says it's Stony out in Hill. August.
Stony Hill is what we call the band.
Okay.
And Leroy is a really good songwriter and a great singer. I've been looking for a singer for 30 years. Somebody that I could have a band with, you know? And I could never quite find the right person. You know, male, female, I didn't care. I needed just the right person. And Leroy is that person. Plus, fortunately, he writes these really great songs. So my wife, Taylor Barton, had been listening to him for a while. And in January of 2019, she said to me, listen, she was playing one particular song. And she said, listen to this guy's voice. This is the way you play. You know, like. So we invited him to come here, just blind, you know, cold call. Wow. And he came to the house, and we got together and just had a great time. And within a couple of days, we were in the studio. So, yeah, we made this record. We got really lucky and got a deal. For old guys to get a deal ain't easy.
For anybody to get a deal, man. Yeah.
It's hard. I mean, it helps if you're an 18-year-old pretty girl, but
yeah.
No, we're not. And but anyway, we got a deal on BMG. We made this record, and we have this song right now out called America. And if you look on YouTube and look at that video of America, anybody who's listening to me and Shane talking here, please take a minute and check out that video. I think that Leroy wrote a song in 2019. We had no way of knowing that the virus and George Floyd and all this stuff was going to come along, but he wrote a song that is perfect for these times.
Sort of prophetic, yeah.
Sort of prophetic. And but it's a good song.
my true love said. Her lips are like some roses fair, the prettiest face and the daintiest hands. I love the ground on where she stands. I love my love and well she knows. I love
the... It is a great song. I did check out the video. Yeah, so everybody check it out. And I'll put a link to it. And but yeah, man, that's a... I'd look forward to hearing the whole record. That's...
Yeah, there's two songs out now, America and Black is the Color. And it's funny, Black is the Color is an old traditional, you know, Kentucky song from Kentucky. And usually played, like Nina Simone did a great version of it back in the 60s. Usually played very slowly with a beautiful melody. Joan Baez did it. Different people. But I always heard it. I wanted to rock it up, you know? So we do the rock version. And Leroy sings it great. He just sings it. And, of course, with a black man singing it, it's a different thing. I always thought that that song was a white guy who's in love with a black girl in the 1800s, right? So he can't be upfront about it. They can't be seen together. And I'm like, black is the color of my true love's hair, you know? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's not what it's about. But to me, that's what it was about.
Mm-hmm.
So I always sang it thinking that and did it this like rocked up version. And I got to play some Albert King licks on it. Which
that's always good.
Always fun. I did almost this whole record with, I have a 1962 Epiphone Sheraton, which is just a magical guitar. And I've had other Sheratons. I've had other 62s that were great, but this one's magic. I got it about 10 years ago now. It was on the bay. I saw it on the bay. I knew from the photo that it was stuff, you know, so I got that. Most of it is that guitar and a couple of Telecasters and a Jazzmaster. And almost the whole record is a Tweed Fender Harvard amp. Yeah. From like 59 or 60, I think. Just a killer little amp. You know, that's the amp famously that Cropper used.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There's two versions of the Harvard. Slightly different preamp tube. One of them is kind of creamy, snouty, like a Tweed Deluxe kind of sound. And one of them is clean. Cropper obviously had the clean one. I've got the creamy, snouty one. You know, but it's a slightly different preamp section. And because I've had both of them and just a great amp. So, yeah, most of the record is that. And I got huge sounds. You'd think it was a Marshall.
Yeah, man. That's one thing I learned is recording with Smalley. I use a little Champ to record a lot of times. Sounds great. Yeah.
Hey, Layla, right?
Yeah, right.
Layla is Champs and Twin Reverb.
Yeah.
Almost the whole record, you know.
In my eyes, birds sing lullabies. I can hear babies cry. Mama's hands are getting tired. No progress over here. They set us back 100 years. No dreamers anymore. Democracy is out the door. God only knows how I miss those days. She only knows how I miss the way we were.
I appreciate your time, G.
Great.
You probably fun talk all day about shit.
Yeah.
But yeah, man. So thanks so much for doing this, man. I really appreciate it.
What guitars are you playing these days?
Well, I don't have any of my ones that I use with Daryl and John. I've got...
That's right. Just tell me. What are they?
Well, I use a Strat. But a guy down in Louisiana built it for me. Here, I'll show you this cool guitar. I want to get your opinion on this. Hold on. I bought this guitar about 5 years ago. It's a 59 330.
Oh, man.
But if you...
All right, if you're still with us, thanks for hanging in there. I hope you enjoyed that. We just kept talking. had to cut it short at some point for this podcast, but just kept talking shop as guitar players do. But anyway, check out GE's website, gesmith.com. New record, Stony Hill with Leroy Bell. Listening to another track right now. Killer, killer stuff. If you'd like to follow me, I'm on Instagram, Guitar Nola. Also, Facebook, Shane Terrio Music. Always love hearing from you. Love your comments. Stay safe out there. See you next time.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.